Soaking up the sun along the Gulf Coast as some Texas beaches get back to business, if not back to normal. Shifting sands plus a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More than 1.5 million new Texas unemployment claims since the pandemic started. Listeners have questions, and we'll put them to the head of the Texas Workforce Commission. Also, some Texas colleges and universities declaring it's back to the classroom this fall. The president of Texas Tech on the pressure for a return to normal. Those stories and a whole lot more coming up on the National News Show of Texas. And we'll get underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this fourth day of partial reopening amid a pandemic in Texas. I'm David Brown. Hope you're doing well on this Monday. Did the weekend feel different for anyone? A little later in the broadcast, the view from Port A, where the weather was perfect, though the outlook not exactly what you'd call completely sunny. Far from it. You may recall not that long ago, experts warned that week two in May would mark the peak of pandemic in Texas. While at the moment, it doesn't seem like that will be borne out. In some places, we are seeing dramatic spikes in coronavirus cases. A federal task force is headed to Amarillo to help officials there respond to an outbreak tied to meatpacking plants. Amarillo's Potter County has reported more than 750 cases, a per capita rate of infection higher than both Harris and Dallas counties. Another hotspot is Abilene with nearly 350 cases at last check, with the rate of increase in cases there surpassing that of the former number one in that category, Amarillo. Amid these spikes in cases, there's the governor's plan to get Texas back to business. Of course, the state's unemployment agency, the Texas Workforce Commission, or TWC, is going to continue to pay benefits to some who choose not to return to work. And yet, we continue to hear from many who are still having problems even filing for unemployment. Here to take on listener questions about the claims process and meeting the surge in demand is the executive director of the TWC, Ed Serna. Ed, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Talking about a lot of money here in unemployment benefits, one concern, I guess, is that, well, could the state run out of money?
No, sir. Mathematically, we could, and I'm going to explain how I said no and yes at the same time. Right before all this started, our trust fund balance was just under $2 billion.
Right.
We've paid out close to $3 billion already. Mm-hmm. So if you do the math, you know, 2 minus 3 gives you a negative number. However, there's a mechanism that's in place that has always been in place that states can use, and we take advantage of it. And that's called a Title 12 loan. It's an interest-free loan from the federal government. We've already submitted our request before our balance got close to zero. We had already submitted our request. So as our balance hits zero, and you can imagine, while we've issued payments, they haven't all drawn those funds yet. Mm-hmm. But as our accounts hit zero, then other funds will get put into the account and we'll continue to pay our customers without delay and without anybody having to take a reduction in benefits.
Given the trajectory right now, do you have a sort of a time horizon where you're approaching that zero hour?
It'll probably be sometime this month where we'll actually hit the zero, and but the money will be there, you know, before we hit the zero, so the payments will just continue.
I see. Well, now, the new guidance from the governor directs your agency to keep paying for some who have the opportunity to work again but can't or they don't want to for some specific reasons, like being over 65 or recovering from the virus or living with someone in either of those categories. Apparently, another acceptable reason is no child care options. Any idea how long these exceptions for continuing to receive unemployment will be extended, or are you just sort of looking for guidance from the governor on this one?
Actually, of course, the governor's office, we coordinate our activity with the governor's office, but a lot of that guidance comes from the health officials. Hmm. Most of the reasons that were listed have to do with health. I'm not sure when health officials will say, look, you know, this thing is at such a point that these risks don't exist anymore. So we'll continue to monitor that. With regard to the child care, right now, health officials are saying, look, child care facilities are open for essential workers, but really not for everybody else yet. When they say it's okay for child care facilities to be safe and more facilities are open to the general public, then that one will probably get removed off of the list.
What about workers with an underlying health condition? There's room in this guidance for other exceptions. What sort of things are you being asked or anticipating being asked to make an exception for at this juncture?
Well, of course, you know, when we point to, and I'm not trying to sound like a broken record, but when we point to state health services, they have a whole list of potential medical issues that could put you in that high-risk category, and we're going to use those issues. And the reason I'm not being as specific and we point back to that list is that list could change.
When your team is already overwhelmed as they are, how difficult is it going to be to review those situations? I presume on a case-by-case basis as the guidance direct, is that how you're approaching this or what?
Yes, sir, but we don't believe it'll be that difficult for several reasons. First of all, people call in to renew their payments. It's called a continuing claim to request the next 2 weeks of their benefit payments. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they tell us that they are able but are not available to take employment, and they maybe have turned down employment. Or we'll look at their reasons. And if it's clear-cut and it matches what we're looking at, it's going to be a pretty black-and-white decision. Some will take advantage of the situation. We recognize that. There are always people like that. But we believe that to be in the very small minority of situations. The only cases that are going to take some investigation or a situation where someone says, I can't do this because of some other situation that's not listed there. You know, I don't feel safe, or the environment that I'm going into, I don't believe it's safe. That's going to take a little bit more investigation at that point.
We continue to hear from listeners who are self-employed and either don't understand if they qualify or they're having problems making it into the TWC to file a claim. What are y'all doing to try to fix that?
We're starting a new practice. We've been sort of experimenting with it on a limited basis, but if we have a new practice of calling outbound. We know that there are several people who have submitted claims, whether they are coming to us because of the CARES Act or are part of the regular unemployment insurance, but they have somehow encountered a problem and they're having issues with that. Of course, our call centers are still getting bombarded with calls. We are regularly getting in excess of 1 million calls a day from individuals. In some cases, that's not 1 million people that need to file a claim. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's people with questions. Mm-hmm. It's people that have some issue with their claim. And in some cases, and I completely understand, it's people that they've gotten everything. They've filed their claim. They've requested payment. We've told them, you're going to get a check on this day. Here's how much. They're just calling to make sure everything is okay. And I understand that. But at any rate, for those people that we know that you've already filed something, but you're having some difficulty, right, or you're showing a zero, we're going to start calling outbound in a really big way and reaching out to individuals to contact them instead of them constantly trying to contact us.
Interesting.
You can still try to contact us. Uh-huh. That's okay. But we're going to be outbound calling and contacting people to get these issues resolved.
We know that this claim system that the TWC is working with is pretty old. How old is this? I mean, when was the last time this was upgraded?
Sure. For those people who understand technology a whole lot better than me, this is a mainframe-based system. It was probably developed in the early 1990s. Now, we have made improvements and we have enhanced it. We were, in fact, in negotiations to replace that system, mm-hmm. to begin the process to replace it. Now, granted, that's a 2 to 3 year project because this
right.
is a massive system.
Right.
But all that got put on hold so we could focus on the big fire, which was this COVID emergency.
Yeah. Do you get a sense that the number of claims have started to taper off? And what's the backlog look like for you?
Sure. You know, I almost hate to... I almost hate to say this because I'm going to jinx myself. We're just seeing a little bit of a decline. I'm not going to say that it's a major decline because for all I know, tomorrow we'll see a big spike because I said, yes, we're seeing a decline. because we still have the oil field workers that more and more of them are getting laid off in large numbers that need to come into the system. We're seeing a little bit of a downtick, but we're not even cautiously optimistic yet. We're a little bit too gun shy. We're not letting up our efforts at all in getting people the support that they need, just because maybe there's been a day or two of a little bit of a downtick.
Do you have a backlog that you're having to go through at the same time as you're taking in these claims?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, yes, sir, we do. We call those assignments, because what happens is someone will submit a claim, but it's incomplete, and we'll need to reach out to them to get that claim complete. Let's say that someone submitted their claim and their last name doesn't match what we have on file. So we have a little bit of a backlog there. We're working through that backlog again with the outbound calls. There's a backlog from the perspective of what we know. Mm-hmm. Now, there's probably a backlog, and we're trying to get a handle on that of what we don't know yet.
Ed Cerna is the executive director of the Texas Workforce Commission. Ed, thanks so much for taking so much time out of your schedule to talk with us and answer some of our listener questions. We certainly do appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Actually, if you didn't hear your question answered, go over to texasstandard.org and hear the extended conversation. We took up a whole lot more questions. We just didn't have time to put them all on the air right now. Let's turn now to our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are you hearing out there?
Well, in that vein, David, we're hearing from folks that find themselves in a wide variety of employment situations. On our Facebook page, longtime listener Brad Emmons writes, "As a Lyft driver, I'm a contract worker. In fact, I've been working more hours because my hourly wage is basically down due to decreased demand. Rideshare has been deemed essential," he writes, "but at least half my riders are doing non-essential travel and not wearing masks. To sum up," he says, "I'm working more, getting paid much less. I can't stop working because of rent, and my job puts me in considerable risk. It's pretty much an endless cavalcade of stress." Of course, David, unemployment and employment situations changing across Texas as some businesses began to reopen over the weekend. We're hearing plenty from our friends and listeners about whether they ventured out of the house. We're seeing lots of responses on Twitter and Facebook. I'll be back with many of those later in the show.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. And Wells will be back with more of your comments. Just noticing a few top stories. Carnival says it plans to restart cruises in August, and J. Crew is filing for bankruptcy. More as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The impact of COVID-19 on the Texas economy has been largely a lot of educated guesswork. But as hard data begins to trickle in, we're getting a better sense of just how hard things could get. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports that new numbers show April state sales tax receipts down 9% compared to last year.
That's the steepest year-over-year decline since 2010, according to Texas Comptroller Glenn Hager, whose office released the numbers Friday. But April's totals are based on sales made in March, when social distancing was just starting. Hager warned next month's report will likely be much worse because it'll reflect an entire month of social distancing and the drop in oil prices. In all, Texas sales tax revenue this period was just over $2.5 billion, down from $2.8 billion reported last April. Sales tax makes up the majority of all taxes collected for the state. The state had steep declines in sales taxes from restaurants, events, movie theaters, gyms, and boutique retail stores, although sales tax receipts from grocery stores, big box retailers, and online sellers rose. April saw huge decreases in other state revenue areas too, like motor vehicle sales and rental taxes, fuel taxes, natural gas and oil production taxes, and hotel occupancy taxes. I'm Brett Jaspers in Fort Worth.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis. including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As many listeners know, our home state is a leading oil producer in the U.S., indeed one of the leading producers of oil in all the world, when the pump jacks are pumping, that is. But many of those pump jacks and oil trucks are at a standstill right now after prices per barrel hit historic lows just a few days ago. It's not just consumption way down because of COVID-19, there's that, but a global price war prior to the pandemic. Some fear losses in the industry could be so severe it won't be able to recover. A whole lot depends on several variables that Marianne Ka specializes in. She's a research scholar and advisory board member at the Center on Global Energy Policy, Columbia University, and she knows Texas very well. For 25 years, she was headquartered in Houston as the chief economist of ConocoPhillips. Marianne Ka, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Which elements do you believe need to fall in place for oil markets to get back to pre-COVID-19 levels?
Well, we lost about 30 million barrels a day of demand growth in April, and that's out of a total global of 100 million barrels a day. That loss is unprecedented, and that's the real problem. I think the OPEC price war, if you will, really didn't matter that much. The issue was we lost a huge amount of oil, and OPEC had trouble dealing with it. And you know, it's not necessarily their role to deal with this. So we need to focus on the demand because that is what's happened. And most of the losses in oil demand are for passenger road transport and air travel. So what does it take to get that oil demand back? Well, first you have to contain the virus and not have additional waves and get a vaccine so that people aren't afraid to travel or go to work. And so the global economy can recover. There is something that has to happen on the oil supply side, though, as well. Mm-hmm. Storage is likely to become full in the next month. But, mm-hmm. You know, the oil doesn't move that quickly. It takes 3 weeks
absolutely.
To get it across the world.
Well, but you're making a point about the storage issue, and we can't stray too far from there, especially given that you can't really increase production in the oil field if you don't have any place to put it. That will, once again, fuel this downward cycle. We saw oil in negative territory.
That was a special thing because the May futures contract was
the
expiring.
Futures contract, sure.
And people
sure.
were afraid, traders who were long were worried about taking delivery because they had nowhere to put it.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, I think prices do need to get down to $15, $10 a barrel to get enough production shut in the U.S. because there is no place to put it.
On the other hand, there are other elements, other factors that could cause these markets to continue to flounder, if not fall. I mean, you have an increase in alternative energy, for example.
There's a good question about whether green stimulus is going to occur. I mean, to me, it's more likely to occur in this administration than other countries. For example, China has just reinstated its subsidies on consumers buying electric vehicles. So some countries around the world are promoting green stimulus. We don't seem to be doing that in the U.S. Now, if somebody like Joe Biden was elected, he has a platform of putting electric vehicle charging infrastructure in, at least along highways. So, you know, it is possible at some point we might get more green stimulus in the U.S., but right now it's primarily focused on Europe. One interesting thing about this whole virus is that all these people are starting to say, we're seeing, you know, this is the end of the Sierra Mountains from Seattle. I've never seen that before. People in India are amazed at the clean air. So when American consumers get used to clean air, won't they want more of it?
What's your sense about the long-term implications for those sorts of policies? Because this impacts everything from, of course, environmental policy to politics, more broadly speaking, to, say, how that interacts with nationalist tendencies that we've seen, certainly with the back and forth between the United States and China, most pointedly. How do you see this playing out ultimately?
Well, I mean, the thing that probably concerns me most is the nationalist tendencies, because that decreases trade and it really hurts global economic growth. And also, it affects manufacturing. One thing that really scared everyone during the worst of the virus when China shut down is, you know, Apple couldn't get parts for its iPhones.
Right.
We don't have ventilators in the U.S. China does. And I think that scared everyone to want to produce more at home. So you could say that will stimulate the U.S. economy if we do that.
Right.
but it detracts from China's economy, which is a big, you know, big source of economic growth in the world, and
but if,
most
in fact,
important to oil demand.
I was just going to say, how does that play out into oil? If in fact we see more manufacturing being done here in the U.S., we do see people saying, "Hey, let's never get caught this way again." Is it possible that that unto itself could further cap oil production?
Well, anything that hurts Chinese oil demand hurts the oil market because they are the largest source of oil demand growth. Everyone knows China's so connected to global oil demand growth. You hear any negative news on China, it immediately impacts the futures market for oil.
You don't think that that could reconfigure itself if, in fact, we become we return to the days of the United States as a kind of manufacturing superpower, which obviously we had moved away from in recent decades?
Well, you know, interesting that you say that, because in the shale revolution, with low-cost, you know, ethane and natural gas, mm-hmm. a huge petrochemical industry developed in the U.S. And, of course, Texas was the beneficiary of this trend.
Come June, July, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the prospects for the Permian and the backbone of the Texas oil industry?
Well, we are definitely going through rough times, and we should have production declining this year as well as next year. It's going to be a very tough situation. But eventually, the resource we have in Texas is good. It's relatively low cost compared to other things that companies can invest in. And it's also a very short cycle time, so you get your returns quickly. Some of the weaker players may leave the industry, but the resource is a good resource, and it will eventually come back.
Marianne Kopp, formerly with ConocoPhillips, now with Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, we got the Texas Roundup just around the corner. Stick around for that coming up on 29 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas oil and gas regulators are considering a controversial move to help ease oversupply as the industry faces historically low prices. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley reports the Texas Railroad Commission could vote Tuesday to force some companies to cut production by 20%.
If you have strong feelings about the state mandating oil production cuts, get your comment emailed to the Railroad Commission before the end of today, ahead of the Tuesday meeting. The three commissioners regulate oil and gas in the state. Ryan Sitton says he backs the proposal. It would exempt smaller producers and fine others $1,000 per barrel for going over the limit. In a Houston Chronicle op-ed, Wayne Christian says he'll vote no and, quote, stick to his free market principles. If approved, it would be the first time the state mandated production cuts since the 1970s. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
And the third commissioner, Christy Craddock, has not indicated how she'll vote. The head of Southwest Airlines is encouraging people to begin flying again as carriers introduce new cleaning protocols and require flight attendants and passengers to wear face masks. Gary Kelly is CEO of the Dallas-based carrier, which lost nearly $100 million in the first quarter of 2020. Speaking on the CBS News program Face the Nation Sunday, Kelly outlined a number of precautions Southwest is taking.
We're using very deep cleanings every night. We're using electrostatic misters, which will kill the virus on surfaces for up to 30 days. We're exercising social distancing, and on board the aircraft, we won't be booking airplanes full so that people can spread out.
Meanwhile, Fort Worth-based American Airlines lost more than $2 billion in the first quarter. The longtime owner of the influential Heart of Texas music stores has died. Ray Hennig passed away Thursday at 91 years old. He opened his first location in Waco nearly 60 years ago before setting up shop in Austin in the early 1970s. Customers included Willie Nelson, Eric Johnson, and a young Stevie Ray Vaughan. In a 2017 interview produced for the Bullock, Texas State History Museum, Hennig described selling Vaughan a beat-up electric guitar.
And he told me so many times after that, he is the Dre I have would never have ever played guitar like I do if I hadn't have found that old 59 Strat hanging on that hook that day.
Hennig's family is hoping to eventually hold a public memorial. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Right now, many Texas parents remain in limbo when it comes to knowing precisely how this 2019-2020 school year is going to play out. But some of the Lone Star State's biggest colleges and universities are pretty unambiguous about what comes next in the fall. School will be open, and in some cases, so will stadiums. Among those institutions of higher learning declaring a return to in-person teaching, learning, and residential life is Texas Tech University. Its president, Lawrence Skuvenek, joins us now. President Skuvenek, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this decision. What was some of the reasoning that factored into it?
We have heard from parents, from students, from faculty, of their concerns that the online experience, the virtual experiences that we're now providing instruction through, are lacking. And I think we have to admit, it doesn't capture the culture of an institution, all of the benefits that the residential collegiate experiences offers. So we knew that we have to get back to some face-to-face, and we'll do that through a very carefully planned, phased-in approach.
Let me ask you, though, there must be, and I'm sure there are, many parents and students who are also concerned that the alternate to online education, going back to class, is unacceptable, certainly now. I mean, who knows what it's going to look like in the fall, but that's just the point, right? Who knows? Why make an announcement now?
So David, we wanted to let them know because many students, I think, are making their decisions on what they might do based on what they think the possibilities would be. And they do want some sort of residential experience, but you raise a very important point. When they come back to campus, it's going to look very different than the campus they saw when they left earlier this year. Our instruction will be delivered through a number of different alternative approaches, some face-to-face in small classes, some online, and then a concept of a hybrid course where some days you may be face-to-face, some days online. We have to control the population density. That also applies to the dorms. The dorms will not be filled to capacity.
You know, we've heard statements from John Sharp, who's head of Texas A&M. We're going to be back in the fall. In fact, we're going to be playing football in the fall. Have you felt pressure from maybe some of the other major colleges and universities here to sort of respond in kind to that announcement from A&M?
No, not at all. However, we have had a lot of discussion about what are we going to do about athletics and football in particular. We all know that football is the economic driver for collegiate athletics in terms of the revenue it generates. Every 2 weeks, all of the presidents of the Big 12 Conference have a conference call, and we continue to explore the possibilities. Maybe an abbreviated schedule. Maybe we will not start at this, you know, regular time. It might extend into the spring. We need some football in order to deal with the financial realities of collegiate athletics.
Quick question on that end as well. Is there any way of knowing to what extent or whether you've lost any money in the course of this, since the pandemic was declared? I mean, has Texas Tech taken a bottom line hit here?
Like every institution we have. For example, when we decided to provide prorated rebates for housing, that was over a $7 million decision. To reimburse dining was $4 million. We decided not to charge our online learning distance fee this summer and to also not require students to pay some of the fees that relate to services they receive on campus. That was a multi-million dollar decision as well. All institutions are feeling a dramatic financial impact from COVID-19.
At what point might you begin to think, wait a minute, this isn't playing out as we expected? I mean, are you going to be revisiting this issue of whether or not to return to classes in the fall of 2020, or is there kind of a point at which you'll rethink this or revisit it?
You know, I can never say never as to what may develop. We have to do what's responsible and safe, but we're committed to moving forward with a phased reopening. And as so many other universities have indicated in the last week or so, you know, we have 3 to 4 months before that time is upon us. And obviously, we have to pay attention to the data, but we'll have a lot of contingencies built into our plan that will help us probably make sure that we can provide a safe environment.
Lawrence Skouvenek is president of Texas Tech University. President Skouvenek, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. Take care.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
My name is Commander Mike Dolbeck. I'm the commanding officer of the USS Texas. The submarine Texas that I work on is the fourth ship to bear the name. The first three were served honorably previously and have been since decommissioned. Texas, the submarine SSN 775, is currently the only ship bearing the name Texas. The true passion that I have and the thing that keeps me and has kept me doing this job for as long as I have is the sailors and the ability to teach them and to help them improve their own lives both in and out of the Navy. For example, I've got report cards from one of my sailors who I had written a letter of recommendation for so that he could go to college. And one of the things that I told him he had to do once he got into college was send me his report cards. And I got informed that he got 2 A's in the classes that he was taking this past semester. To be able to improve the lives of these fine young men and women is truly an honor. They are my family. You know, I spent, in the past 3 years, I've spent more time with these young men and women underway on board this submarine than I did at home with my own daughter. The thing that I would want my daughter to know when I am away is that I'm proud of her and that she can do anything that she wants as long as she puts her mind to it. And that whatever she does, I'll be happy for her. I'm never really away. I'm always with her. It's just I'm not with her at that present moment. My wife and I, we do a lot to make sure that that I'm still present at home. We record books, me reading books to her so that she sees me each and every day. But it's the calling is the act of service, the service to others. And whether or not the people that you're serving realize what you're doing, we are the silent service, so we don't talk about the operations that we do. But the fact that we are out there and working as hard as we do, it's one of the things that my parents taught me very early on was the value of that service to others and how that is important to our great nation. Even though I wasn't born in Texas, having served on board for 3 years on board the fine warship Texas, my heart truly does belong to Texas. This is Commander Mike Dolbeck, the commanding officer of the USS Texas, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Hey, you're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. When it comes to music education, there are some things students just can't do without. An instrument, for starters. And as of late, quality internet, too. KERA's Miguel Perez reports on how the digital classroom reveals a digital divide for music students.
Eduardo Mesa is warming up as he waits for the rest of his classmates to join the day's video lesson. His teacher, Rafael Siemers, looks on as the third grader plays the D major scale on his cello.
Amazing. That was really good. So did you practice your scale this week?
Siemers is a teaching artist with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra's Young Musicians Program. The initiative launched last year with the goal of improving access to music education for kids in Southern Dallas.
We try to make it as accessible for families as possible. They don't have to pay anything. The instruments are donated to them for the time that they're in the program, and they get books for free, like music books.
As school shuttered, students took their instruments home, and the program moved online, which can make group lessons a little tricky. 10-year-old Luciano Lopez plays the double bass in Siemers' class.
Sometimes they glitch, sometimes it doesn't go at the same speed, so it's been a little bit harder.
Especially if everyone is trying to play at the same time. The sudden shift to online learning has made it clear that there are disparities in internet access and quality among students. The latest data from the Pew Research Center says 1 in 5 kids between kindergarten and 12th grade don't have computers or high-speed internet connections. The so-called homework gap hits low-income families the hardest, like the ones the DSO is trying to reach.
A few of us actually made phone calls to all the families to make sure if they had internet and if they had a device that they could access. So that was kind of a big priority for us.
Reliable Wi-Fi isn't the only tool music teachers have to worry about.
My name is Amanda Vessel. I teach kindergarten through fifth grade music, and then I have a bucket percussion group, which it's like drums, but they actually play on buckets.
Vessels has about 600 students at Diamond Hill Elementary in Fort Worth, most of whom are economically disadvantaged. Her students have access to instruments and buckets at school, but they've had to make do at home.
They're having to find things in their house, like pots and pans, that kind of thing. One little girl, she got a shoebox and she put rubber bands around it. They've made maracas, you know, out of beans and, you know, shakers with paper cups, plastic cups, just whatever they have at home.
Vessels tapes her lessons and shares them online. She's made contact with about 300 students, and she's determined to reach all of them.
You know, the world is so unstable and unsettling for all of us, and especially for kids. And that kind of gives them some normalcy to kind of stick to, and they can be creative.
Jess Garland has also been working to get instruments into her students' hands. She runs Swan Strings, a nonprofit that offers free guitar and harp lessons to kids in Dallas who wouldn't otherwise get the chance to play.
I've been, at this point, kind of smuggling guitars to students. Like, I'll have parents come by and they'll pop the trunk open and I put the guitar in and they just drive off, you know.
Garland is also a community liaison and a teacher in the DSO's Young Strings program.
There are some music theory things that you can do and learn, but not actually having an instrument, that is a negative impact. They definitely need to have something at home to practice.
It's hard to provide students with instruments during a shutdown. At least online, there are resources to keep kids engaged. The Fort Worth Symphony Orchestra recently launched a virtual music lab with free playlists, webinars, and at-home performances by musicians like keyboardist Buddy Bray.
When you're playing for a camera, you're not necessarily performing. You're more trying to connect with one person, the person on the other end of that computer screen.
Now, teachers may not be able to provide all of the tools their students need right now, but as long as they can keep connecting with them and sharing their love of music, they're happy. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Hey, listen, we have a lot of coverage online over at texasstandard.org. For instance, the very latest reporting on COVID-19 and spread of coronavirus cases. You can keep up with all that over at texasstandard.org. Check it out. We're going to have Wells Dunbar returning to join us with a talk of Texas in just a minute. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine. providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Well, here in Texas, it was a big weekend at the beach for lots of folks with the governor's COVID-19 stay-at-home order expiring last week. Many stir-crazy Texans flocked to the popular Gulf Coast tourist destination locals call Port A, Port Aransas. Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios went to check out the sights and found the weather near perfect, though with a mixture of metaphoric clouds on the horizon.
A steady stream of cars, trucks, and golf carts drive along the sand of Port Aransas' beaches on Saturday morning. Along the water, beachgoers set up canopies and chairs. Jason Arredondo and his family are taking a day trip from San Antonio.
I figure with some restrictions getting lifted, you know, it's pretty safe, probably. I don't think the governor would tell us. I don't think he would lift some of the restrictions if it was still as bad as everybody thought it was in the beginning.
After weeks in quarantine, Arredondo says they all welcome this chance to get out of the house. It's early, and most people are spread apart. By 2 p.m., further down the beach, there's barely any space between cars, canopies, and people. Beth Logue is with a group of friends visiting from College Station.
It's probably a little bit too crowded, and people should be still keeping distance from those that they haven't been in their houses with. But as long as people are like following protocol and standards and kind of trying to stay away from people, then this shouldn't be a big issue as long as you're washing your hands and you're following safety protocol.
The city's mayor, Charles Bouillon, had previously enacted public health orders that restricted a lot of the island's activity. But he rescinded those after the governor's orders last week. Still, Bouillon says,
I think it's probably a bit too early to open it up, but understand this. We couldn't, with our small police force, we had no way of controlling the masses of people that came over here.
The mayor says COVID-19 isn't over. We're talking by phone because Bouillon himself is social distancing.
It's here to stay a while. So those who are at risk, like myself, for example, two heart surgeries and a cancer operation within the last 10 months, it's best for those folks and for me to stay inside the house.
Port Aransas has less than 10 confirmed cases of COVID-19 right now. Mayor Bouillon says he believes Nueces County, which includes Port Aransas and Corpus Christi, will see a spike now that Texas has loosened restrictions. Statewide, Texas has surpassed 30,000 cases. That's part of why Shannon Solomai is worried about the influx of visitors.
I can't go to our gas station without feeling like people are not going to take precaution instead of trusting that they will.
She's lived here for 12 years and is an incoming city councilwoman.
And I think that's where we have an issue, or where, you know, the line kind of gets drawn. I know that our stores are doing the best that they can, but, you know, when you've got 20 or 30 people all coming in at one time and no one is social distancing, you're going to have a problem.
Over the weekend, most of the island's retail stores reopened. Restaurants, too. Per the governor's orders, they're all limited to 25% occupancy.
Thank you for calling Shell's. This is Jesse. How may I help you?
On Saturday evening, cooks at Shell's are prepping for their second day doing table service for up to 9 people. Heber Stone owns this restaurant.
It scares me a little bit, but it almost excites me, too, because I know I have an opportunity to pay it forward and an opportunity to show everybody what this little restaurant can do.
Port Aransas' economy is based 100% on tourism. While stay-at-home orders were in effect, the restaurant was doing to-go orders, but Stone still had to lay off or furlough employees. He says, in a way, Hurricane Harvey tearing up the island in 2017 prepared him for this.
It's just, I got used to things I never thought I could. And then when this little hit came along, it really just, I was like, well, here goes another one, but I know we'll get through it, and we do.
Port Aransas has bounced back before. Now, whether the summer tourist season ramps up or slows down in the next few weeks could depend on the spread of the virus. I'm Joy Palacios in Port Aransas.
and you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Monday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. How's it going?
Going well. What are you seeing on social media?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, and as we just heard, the reopening of Texas this weekend continuing to dominate chatter on social media with lots of folks chiming in about what they've seen, what they've experienced. We just heard about some of the beach scenes in Port Aransas, the outdoor activities, hearing about some situations like that. Via Facebook, John McKiernan Gonzalez is in Austin, and he says in the Greenbelt area there, this popular outdoor area, he said maybe half the people had masks, and there was plenty of distancing at Town Lake Park in Austin. However, almost no masks and very little distancing. That's the scene outdoors on that one perspective, but also hearing more about the reopening of businesses across the state. On Facebook as well, Ann Sansone says she carried on as usual by mostly staying put since shelter-in-place orders were announced in March. She made one retail curbside pickup this weekend, but the margin of error is too great out there, she says, to venture out. She adds that she's grateful for Judge Jenkins' leadership in Dallas County, noting that Dallas had three of its highest days of COVID cases lately, and she adds that we haven't seen the two-week decline that indicates opening up is the thing to do. Similarly, Jose Fonseca says, I'll wait another week or two before going outside. This has nothing to do with political affiliations. I'm just trying to be safe. And I think Jose hitting there on, some of these sort of cultural or political divides in the way that the reopening has taken root among some groups of people.
You know, something interesting here, you know, we were talking about the sort of reopening versus public safety. A very interesting story that the Dallas News has got going on right now. Mitchell Schnernan reporting, come on back, says Baylor Scott and White in a bid to entice patients and boost revenue. This is part of a story that we've been covering just a bit here, where you've seen, you know, the cutback in the number of elective surgeries and that sort of thing actually hitting the bottom line of a lot of healthcare providers. Now they're saying, hey, listen, we need the revenue. Y'all come on back. And they're trying to tout new safety measures and low infection rates and that kind of thing, you know, to get
people exactly. Back to the hospital. When it's needed the most, it's bizarre. It's not good to see things like hospitals, their bottom lines hurting due to those measures. It almost reminds me of the sort of situation in the news industry, how we're seeing many newspapers engage in layoffs and furloughs, things like that, just as their services are most needed. One of the sort of ironies that's been promulgated here by COVID-19. You know, we heard from a lot of folks who didn't go out. We're also hearing from some people that did go out this weekend via Facebook. Joshua Boston says he went out, had a great time. He noticed that traffic was light. Few people were wearing masks, but everyone seemed to keep a fair distance from each other. Tweet here from Sarah. She notes that she went out for some seafood and beer at her neighborhood place. They were all taking precautions. It was delicious and got me out of my grumpy funk. So obviously some folks taking advantage of it. Just saw some, you know, there's just some incredible scenes out there. The photographers at our home station, KUT Austin, they were out and about documenting the reopening of some of these businesses. Saw this great photo essay or a great report in the Texas Tribune as well, where another photographer had some photos of the reopening of a mall here in Austin.
Yeah.
Very, very sparse, you know, people with masks on. Strange scenes, scenes from this sort of tentative reopening of businesses across Texas.
Yes, indeed. We continue to cover it here at The Standard. You can keep up with everything Texas at texasstandard.org. Out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.